Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's Radio Sai Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind. This week, as always, we're going back to the Bhagavata Vahini. We've been talking about it for over a few months now. We are in that part where, as we've led on from the beginning of the book till now, the most important part of the Bhagavatam, where Sukha Maharishi is talking about the Krishna avatar. The part where, the part for which Parikshit the king was waiting, and this finally come. We've been talking about it for the past few weeks. Every time we have come back to the Bhagavata Vahini Satsang. The last time when we spoke to you, we spoke about, the various asuras who were vanquished in the course of the Krishna avatar, especially the childhood part of, Lord Krishna's life. Before we proceed with the narration, as always, let's begin by offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sai Ram, Arvind.
Sai Ram, Prem. Sai Ram to all our listeners. As Prem introduced, we had gone through the stories of how Krishna vanquished several demons and killed cruel kings. And we saw that every act that Krishna did had a great inner, deeper significance. It achieved multiple purposes, multiple goals. And that's how it is when the avatar comes. So many things get compressed into each and every word and act of the avatar. So today we will proceed with some more that we have left out. Swami has of course not gone into detail description of all these episodes and events, but he makes a mention of all these names in the Bhagavata Vahini. So both of us felt that it would be good, it would be interesting and also educative to actually go through the detailed stories, not in great detail, but to some detail, so that we can get the insights, the learnings, and also enjoy the variety that is present in the Krishna avatar. And that is the reason we are going into, I think, last time when we were doing the satsang, we went through how Krishna defeated or killed or annihilated or vanquished Pralamba, Dhenukasura, Keshi, Arishta, Kuvalaya Pida, all these. So today, I think last time we had stopped at Mushtika, and today we will be starting from there. In fact, that is how even the Krishnashtakam begins. The Krishnashtakam begins with the line, Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsa Chanura Mardhanam. So I think that starting point of the Krishnashtakam will be the starting point of our Bhagavata Vahini Satsang also, because today we will be going into the annihilation and killing of Chanura and Kamsa.
Right, and Chanura is supposed to be one of those very close aides of Kamsa. He's considered to be one of the ministers who spoiled Kamsa's mind to do many of the atrocities that he did, usurping the kingdom, imprisoning his father Ugrasena. All of this was done under the advice of some of these demons we've spoken about. Chanura being one of those who are very close to Kamsa, and the others being, I think, Narakasura, whom we're going to talk about, and another Asura whom we addressed last time we were speaking about. So all of these people, I mean, so much so of what Swami says about avoid bad company. Because Kamsa is not born into a bad family, he's born into a noble family, but purely because of the company that he has kept, based on the advice of the kind of people that he has listened to, and this is where he has come to. But of course, the history of that character of Kamsa is also very interesting. But before that, I think the first one is Chanura. He is the one who is dealt with, right?
Correct. In fact, it is like a pair. The pair of wrestlers called Chanura and Mushtika. Mushtika and Chanura are supposed to be the best wrestlers in the entire kingdom. Apart from being, Chanura, you said, was an advisor to Kamsa, but I think as his hobby he had developed, so he was a very well-built, stocky, muscular person.
I think
person.
All of them, even Jarasandha, whom we're going to talk about.
Father-in-law.
Right, he was also supposed to be a wrestler by passion, and that's how later Bhima comes to have a bout with him and kills him.
You're revealing some future stories.
Right.
So anyway, so we saw how Krishna, according to different versions, either tames the wild elephant Kuvalaya Pida or kills that elephant Kuvalaya Pida. And as he proceeds to the wrestling pit, Krishna is pitted against Chanura. I think the word pitted comes from these wrestling pits, you know, right, because you're put into the same pit like them. So he's pitted against Chanura and Balrama is pitted against Mushtika. And as we had clarified a fortnight back, when Swami speaks about these evil beings annihilated by the Lord, he also includes those who have been killed by Balrama as well. So that makes it very clear that Balrama is also one among the avatars. And that is what happens. Mushtika is wrestling with Balrama while Krishna is wrestling with Chanura. And everybody around, you know, they feel it is very, very unfair, because here are boys who are not even out of their teens. So they are not well built. And we know even biologically, the human body possibly achieves its highest growth or it's the most strong in the late 20s, maybe 25 to 30 onwards, after which again the process of aging sets in. But before this, you're not. Any day a 25-year-old is mostly more strong and powerful than a 16 or 17-year-old. So it is very unfair that two fully grown men are pitted against boys. On top of that, these are not ordinary men. These are very, very powerful men who have excelled in the art of wrestling. They are also very powerful, very well built. They are bodybuilders. So everybody feels it is grossly unfair. But soon they realize that when God is on one side, it doesn't matter how powerful the other side is. Because as they had expected, it indeed becomes a one-sided match. But what they had not expected is it becomes a one-sided match in favor of these teenage boys. Because after a few minutes of running around, you know, it's not like Krishna and Balrama directly lock horns and start fighting with Mushtika and Chanura. Being nimble and fleet-footed, they keep running around, you know, and in that wrestling pit, keep escaping Mushtika and Chanura. And these two huge bulk-bodied wrestlers, they begin to realize that what was their strength has actually now become their weakness, because their strength is their huge bulk, their muscles, their hulk, all that, and that's a weakness if you have to move quickly. So for hours on the end, you know, these two boys keep running around the pit and they totally exhaust Mushtika and Chanura. And when they are exhausted in one blow, before the audience can even realize it, Mushtika is killed by Balrama and Krishna rains blows on Chanura's head and he's also killed. So it comes as a very, very strong anticlimax, but definitely something that brings cheer and joy in the hearts of all the citizens and denizens of Mathura. Because, as you said, Kamsa was a tyrannical ruler and he established his tyranny and his evil through all these instruments of his, Mushtika, Chanura, and these were the kind of demons that the common people had to face if they turned up against Kamsa. And seeing those two faces of tyranny being subdued, being made to literally bite the dust, was something that cheered everyone. And so, though there was a moment of shocked silence, it was not a shocked silence, it was a silence of disbelief. They could not believe that Mushtika and Chanura have finally bit the dust. And even more, the disbelief came from the fact that it has been achieved by two teenage boys. But once that moment of awe and moment of disbelief passed over, it was celebration. It was celebration in every heart except that of Kamsa, because Kamsa's heart was now beating the rhythm of extreme fear. He almost turned white and pale in fear, because before his own eyes, he has seen the capabilities of these two apparently young boys, because they have brought down two wrestlers whom he considered as the greatest in the entire country.
Right, and then it finally shifts to Kamsa. You know, many times when you listen to the story of this part of Lord Krishna's life, you often think, you know, you go back to the story of Jaya Vijaya, and you wonder how come Kamsa is not one of them. Because till this point, he is probably like the arch villain of the whole story. You know, the whole thing revolves around him. The whole story of Krishna's birth is actually so intricately connected to him. Because as we all know, I think we've come past that part where he hears that Akashvani or the voice from in the skies, where he's told that the eighth child of his own sister Devaki, who is married to Vasudeva, is going to be his nemesis. And that's when he decides to get rid of his sister in the first place, but then he lets her go because Vasudeva says that I will offer you every child that she gives birth to. And from then, Swami says that he is filled with this fear, but even through the fear, he is actually thinking of the Lord. Right? I think we've spoken about this even when we were talking about one of the Navaveda Bhakti Margas, which is Namasmarana, where Swami
Nindastuti,
or having hatred for the Lord, but in the process of that hatred, you think of the Lord incessantly. Right? Sishupala is supposed to be one of them, and Kamsa is supposed to be one of them, because he gets an experience which all of us would probably aspire for, but not in the real emotional sense, because he sees Krishna everywhere in the run up to this event of him coming to Mathura and standing face to face with him. The story goes that Kamsa sees him everywhere. You know, he's not able to sleep. Every night he wakes up in the middle thinking of Krishna, who would come to him and would kill him. And this whole episode is centered around this King Kamsa.
In fact, if you narrate to anybody without mentioning the name of Kamsa, here is a being who is ruling over a kingdom. During the day, wherever he sees Lord Krishna. In the night, every night he dreams of Krishna. I mean, people might think that we are describing a great devotee of the Lord, a person who loves the Lord. And it is only when you mention the name you realize that, oh, no, it is Kamsa. So, as you rightly said, it is the intensity that matters. Of course, emotionally the experience may be different. One may go through pain or pleasure. But we know that the Lord is beyond pain and pleasure. He is beyond the dualities that the world is afflicted with. And therefore, the experience of the Lord is also like that. What matters is the intensity with which we seek Him. Whether we seek Him to love Him or whether we seek Him so that we can kill Him, apparently that doesn't seem to matter, because as we had discussed during the Navaveda Bhakti Marga, there is stuti, there is bhakti stuti, there is also ninda stuti. So,
right. In fact, I think even during that occasion we had mentioned that Swami had indicated once that ninda stuti is not something which will work in the Kali Yuga. But actually if you look at it, it's so very clear, because when you look at some of these things which Swami would say, that, you know, in the Satyuga you have to do tapas, in the Treta Yuga you have to do yajnas, in the Dwapara you have to do archana, and in Kali Yuga Swami says Namasmarana is good enough. So if you look at it, actually over the yugas, the importance for intention actually goes on rising. There it was physical activity, you had to physically do tapas, you had to physically sit and do a yajna. Slowly over the ages you see that the intention with which an act is done gets more importance than the act itself. And that's why, you know, it's not enough that you're thinking of the Lord, but it's important in with what attitude, with what emotion you're thinking of the Lord. That becomes more important in Kali Yuga. So Kamsa and Sishupala might have gotten away with it, but not you and I, if you think that, you know, let's get angry with Swami and, reach God. But looking at Kamsa, I was just going through...
If I can just interrupt at this point, I feel that also is a blessing in a way, because it is easier for us to, you know, tame our intentions, because all said and done, I don't think we have the capacity to do what Kamsa did,
right,
or what Hiranyakashipu did, because what Swami says is the amount of research and tapas and penance and things they have done, Swami says that Hiranyakashipu could travel to the sun and back. That is the kind of accomplishment and achievement they did. So I feel in a way it is a blessing from the Lord that achievement and accomplishment and tapas and sadhana have taken a back seat, and what is in the front seat is the intention, because intention is something that definitely I feel I can control much better. So I'm indeed grateful to Swami that I may not get the advantage of getting Swami by Ninda Stuti, but with such a beautiful form, with such beautiful grace and love, I just can't imagine how anybody can ever do Ninda Stuti of Swami.
Absolutely. And the other point which I was referring to in Kamsa is this one. It's quite surprising how a character like Kamsa comes in a family which is so noble. because you talk of
Ugrasena and
Vasudeva and Devaki, and all of them are supposed to be very noble people in that sense. In fact, that is one of the reasons when Vasudeva comes up and says that I'll give you every son which is born to me, even a person like Kamsa agrees, because he knows that Vasudeva is so noble that he'll not go back on his words, that he can be trusted. So how is it that he was born in such a family? In fact, that is where his ancestry or his history comes. Apparently, he is not born to Ugrasena. He was actually born to his mother Padmavati and Asura by name Drumila, who comes in the disguise of Ugrasena, and then he fathers Kamsa along with Padmavati. And it seems Ugrasena is away in the war. When he comes back, he finds that his wife has been impregnated and she's given birth to Kamsa. But out of his nobility, he accepts Kamsa as his son and he brings him up. And that's where, you know, eventually he overthrows the father, because he grows up to be somebody who is actually mightier than the rest of them because of this, you know, the fatherhood that he has. And that's how he eventually builds this alliance with Jarasandha, who is also supposed to be a very demonic king of that time.
I think he marries the daughters of Jarasandha.
Through the marriage to Jarasandha's daughters. What are the names?
I had got them.
Asti and Prapti.
Asti and Prapti, correct.
Right,
yes.
Asti and Prapti. They're the daughters of Jarasandha, whom Kamsa marries in order to build this alliance. And in fact, it so happens that Jarasandha actually tries to attack Mathura, and that's when he's surprised by the valor of Kamsa, who defeats the entire army of Jarasandha single-handedly. And that's when he sees that he's a worthy son-in-law of mine, and, you know, he gives him his daughters in marriage. But interesting thing is the history or the past birth of Kamsa. And as I was saying, he's not Jaya and Vijaya, but he actually comes from an illustrious family where all of his father and his uncle were killed by Lord Vishnu. Because in the previous birth, he was actually a son of Hiranyaksha.
Oh, okay.
He was a Asura, and later he was again born as Kalanemi, another Asura who comes in the Ramayana. And correct. In Ramayana, he is born as Maricha's son. So even Maricha was killed by Rama. Even
Kalanemi, I think, was killed by Hanuman.
Yeah, Kalanemi gets killed by Hanuman. But he is the son of Maricha. So in both his previous lives, his father gets killed by Lord Vishnu. Right? So I think comes from an illustrious family in that sense. And the interesting thing is about the six children that he kills. And I think that's very, very interesting. If you look at it, I mean, just like how we have said it in Ramakatha Raswani so many times. When you've read the story so many times, you've been hearing it from your childhood, we've been seeing it as movies, as television series. I mean, the importance of an event like this, or the melancholy of an event like this, is sometimes lost on us.
Correct.
You know, six children being killed on the day of their birth. You know, what sort of a pain it will have given their parents, and what sort of a event itself it is, you know, something like this happening. And to think of it as happening to God's own family in that sense. You know, we turn to Swami thinking that He'll protect our family. Hmm. But if this is the fate of the family in which God is born in, I mean, then there must be something to it. And, you know, that's why they say that it's so important to see that ancestry of how it happens. The thing is, all the six children that Kamsa kills were actually his children in a previous birth, who get the curse that he will be killed by their own father.
Okay.
And that's how Kamsa becomes the uncle. They are born to Devaki as six children, and only six children he kills. And that's the other thing. The seventh child is considered to be a miscarriage, where actually Balrama is shifted to the womb of Rohini. And it is considered that the seventh child is a miscarriage. And the eighth one again becomes Mahamaya, who gets swapped with Lord Krishna.
Correct. So, indeed.
Right, so actually, he killed only six children, and those six children were his
own children.
His own children, and before that, they were actually sages who get cursed to be born as Asura's son. And
Oh God!
I think everything has a reason for that. And the other story, I think we narrated this when we were talking about the birth of Krishna also. When Kamsa actually relents a little and becomes a bit compassionate, when he thinks that anyway, only the eighth child is going to be my nemesis. Why do I have to kill the first seven children? But then Narada is the one who comes and plays that trick in between. So many versions of that. It seems that one is that he picks up a flower, and a flower which has eight petals. So he tells Kamsa, you know, which petal is the first one, which one is the eighth one. So he says it depends on where you start counting from.
Hmm.
Right? And that's when it strikes Kamsa that eighth child, but counting from where? Right. And the other one is that Narada goes into the garden when actually Kamsa is playing with his maidens, and that time he plays a similar game like that. They're all standing in a circle, then he gives each one a number, and then he shuffles them around and he says, what was one has become seven, what was eight has become two. And he says, so how do you know what is one and what is eight? So
he's prodding him to kill the...
Right, because that is how actually these six children get their liberation from the curse that they've, you know, had to be born into. So, I mean, it's a big lesson for all of us, you know. It's very easy for us to look at an event and say, oh, this is a sad event, or this is an unpleasant event, this is a melancholic event. But we don't know that. I mean, we have to always remember that nothing happens without a reason.
And if viewed from different perspective, the same thing can be a melancholy event, same thing can be a happy event, same thing can be a liberating thing. So perspective becomes so important. And I think the best perspective for us to put on would be the perspective of faith, that nothing that God does is ever without a meaning, everything has a purpose. And therefore, whether I understand it or not, let me know that it is for the ultimate good of everyone. Otherwise, the Lord wouldn't have done it. I think that is the faith with which we will have to lead our lives if we have to find peace in our lives. Otherwise, we'll constantly be bombarded with, okay, that is God, that is fine, but why this, but why that, but why this? Even in Swami's case, we will wonder, we may even end up questioning Swami, Swami, why did you do this? Why did you not do this? Why are you allowing this? Why are you not allowing this? No answers that we can provide here as a satsang team or as Radio Sai, or I don't think anybody can ever provide that answer. In order to know the answer, we have to become God himself, as we had discussed in the previous satsang, Brahma with Brahma Eva Bhavati. But till then, it would be best to hold on to this faith that nothing the Lord does is ever bad for anything. It's always the ultimate good. And in that faith, if we are able to live, we'll be peaceful throughout our lives. Always.
And I think that incident, which, I mean, even as I was going through that, it struck me as so very important to keep in mind, where actually Krishna swaps places with Mahamaya.
Mm.
Actually, Mahamaya is born to Yashoda and he is born to Devaki, and they swap places. So she comes to Kamsa, but, you know, though Yashoda gave birth to Maya, Krishna comes to her. I think that is a very symbolic event where the Lord and the Maya come to the earth at the same time, but you can choose which one you actually embrace and which one becomes a part of your life.
Absolutely. And just completing Kamsa, as it is said that after Krishna kills Chanura, as Kamsa has turned pale in fear, he doesn't give any time, you know. The boy jumps out of the wrestling pit, and it's in the assembly where all have gathered to see, and at the highest spot is Kamsa himself watching the proceedings. So Krishna jumps out of the sand pit, wrestling pit, and rushes straight towards Kamsa. And everybody is stunned into silence and inaction because of what they have witnessed. They have seen the greatest of wrestlers being felled, and they have seen him lose his life. So there is that shock and that inaction because of what they have witnessed. Utilizing those few moments of inaction, Krishna jumps out of the pit and rushes straight to Kamsa. None of the guards, nobody steps forward also, because as I said, they're all transfixed, frozen. And Kamsa is also more or less frozen in fear. And Krishna directly clenches the crown of Kamsa, you know, and knocks it off. Then holding by the hair, he drags him. And Kamsa comes rolling down those steps, those royal steps that have led up to his throne. And then, you know, Krishna pounces on him, beats him, sits on his chest, bends back, and, you know, he decapitates Kamsa. And it's almost like another moment of shock, which is followed by rejoicing. Because if people rejoice so much for the killing of Mushtika and Chanura, one can only imagine the amount of rejoicing when Kamsa is dead. So it is said that even his own soldiers, Kamsa's own soldiers, feel that joy when Kamsa is killed. Because unless you are, you know, absolute black, nobody, I think, can stand absolute black. It is like you need You need to be absolute black to be able to be absolutely to do absolute black deeds. Just like it is said that in order to experience the Lord in all His glory, you have to be pure, nirmalam, pure. Otherwise, we look at God with the taints and mistakes that lie in us. We think that God is selfish. We think that God is greedy. We think that God is whatever, you know, God is having desires. We think that God, because these are all the defects in us. Unless I am pure white, I cannot see the bright white that the Lord is. That is what we meant when we discussed Brahma with Brahma eva bhavati. I have to become like Brahman in order to experience Brahman. In the same way, unless you are absolutely black, I don't think anybody can tolerate this. So though the soldiers who have sworn to fight on behalf of Kamsa might have some evil tendencies, even they had become sick and nauseated at the amount of misdeeds and the number of things that Kamsa had perpetrated. So therefore, when Kamsa is finally killed, it is actually rejoicing all around. Not only are the people of Mathura rejoicing, the soldiers, everyone seemed to rejoice, because immediately Ugrasena is released from the jail that Kamsa had imprisoned him in. He is crowned as the emperor again of Mathura, and Krishna goes and meets his bodily parents, which is Devaki and Vasudeva. And that is the killing of Kamsa. After which, I think, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break. On the other side of the break, we'll continue with the other asuras and the evil people whom Krishna killed or was responsible in their annihilation. So don't go anywhere. Enjoy this song. On the other side of the song, we will continue with the Bhagavatam.
वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
दुख भंजन 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 तेरो नाम ओ साई
भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
संग बांधी प्रेम की डोरी
तुम संग बांधी प्रेम की डोरी
तुम संग बांधी प्रेम की डोरी
तुम संग बांधी प्रेम की डोरी
सुमिरन करूं तेरो नाम ओ साई
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 पतितो धारण भक्त परायण
पतितो धारण भक्त परायण
पतितो धारण भक्त परायण
पतितो धारण भक्त परायण
परतीश्वर साई राम
परतीश्वर साई राम
परतीश्वर साई राम वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
दुख भंजन तेरो नाम ओ साई
दुख भंजन तेरो नाम ओ साई
भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई
तुम संग बांधी प्रेम की डोरी
तुम संग बांधी प्रेम की डोरी
सुमिरन करूं तेरो नाम ओ साई
सुमिरन करूं तेरो नाम
पतितो धारण भक्त परायण
पतितो धारण भक्त परायण
परतीश्वर साई राम
परतीश्वर साई राम
परतीश्वर साई राम भक्त वत्सल तेरो नाम ओ साई दुख भंजन तेरो नाम
वेलकम बैक डियर लिसनर्स वील नाउ प्रोसीड टू द नेक्स्ट demon or if I can say asura that Krishna killed. One thing that must be mentioned here is that after the killing of Kamsa, there is a change that is noticed in the strategy that Krishna adopts. Krishna apparently no longer exhibits superhuman skills or superhuman abilities actually, but he does all things in a kind of worldly manner. One can definitely see the divinity that is there, but still one can also get deluded into thinking that, hey, if I also followed a similar strategy, I think I also could have done what Krishna did. That is the kind of strategy that Krishna adopts, because these kind of superhuman leelas, what we saw dancing on the head of Kaliya, as a little baby killing Dhenukasura, Arishta, and even that, I forget that, bullock cart demon.
Right.
Yeah, so all of these things were really miraculous, and anybody who saw it had their jaw drop open in awe. But after this, Krishna adopts a more kind of a strategy where you feel that I too can do it. And it is so similar to like how we see in Swami. All the leelas, the Bala leelas of Bala Sai, the young Sai when he was small, it slowly metamorphosed into kind of mahimas and leelas where you need to have that kind of devotion and ability to see how it's a miracle. Otherwise, one may get fooled or deluded into thinking that, hey, maybe I too can do this. I too can do this. And I think that is what has given foolish courage and audacity to many people to try to even imitate Bhagwan, imitate Swami, try to act like him. In fact, speaking of imitation, I think we should go right away to Paundraka, because Paundraka was one such friend of Jarasandha. Again, it's all like birds of the same feather. We will see that all these people whom Krishna has killed, they're all associated together. Kamsa, Jarasandha, Kala Yavana, Paundraka, Banasu, all of these people, you know, Dantavakra, Shishupala, they're all together, you know. It's all birds of a feather and them flocking together. It's just that they didn't flock together against Krishna in one place, but at different points in time, they take up arms against Krishna. And Paundraka is a very, very typical case, possibly very relevant for especially Sai devotees the world over in this day and age, because Paundraka began to claim that he is only Lord Krishna. He said that he is the avatar of Krishna. He declares that he is the avatar. But one thing that he flounders and mistakes in is that when we look at the avatars of the Lord, each avatar is so unique and special, you know. Even if we take the Dashavatar, Matsya, fish, Kurma, tortoise, Varaha is like the wild boar. Then Narasimha is half man, half tiger, lion. Then Vamana is a dwarf. Parshurama is like a sage. Rama is a perfect man, handsome, amazing. Krishna, the supreme. You know, it's each one has the same divinity, but the worldly characteristics and features are so different. That is why it is said creation is divine while imitation is human. Because humans can only imitate. And like we see today happening in places like Mudenalli and other places, that happened even in the Dwapara Yuga. It's amazing because Paundraka begins to imitate Krishna. He begins to wear the peacock feather on his crown. He begins to carry the flute in an attempt to play the flute. I'm sure it would have been a cacophony for the devotees of the Lord. But there were people who began to think that, hey, maybe this is right. Maybe this is only Lord Krishna. And he proclaimed himself. You know, kings in those days would give themselves titles. Usually this title is something that had to be conferred by a supreme authority. But those kings who foolishly think that they themselves are the supreme authority, they themselves give themselves different titles. And this Paundraka gave himself the title of Vasudeva. So he began to call himself Vasudeva, and he wanted everybody to address him in the endearing fashion with the same kind of words that people would use to call Krishna. And what is interesting is in all this, when this comes to Krishna's notice, Krishna doesn't do anything at all. People say that, oh Krishna, what is happening there is atrocity. He is telling that he is you and, you know, he is doing all this and how can you sit silent? You know, don't you want to save your devotees from going into wrong things? But Krishna doesn't do anything, you know, because what Krishna says is that a devotee of Krishna can never actually fall. A devotee of Krishna can never get deluded. If you are getting deluded, then you are not a devotee. Just like Paundraka proclaimed himself to be Vasudeva, you are proclaiming yourself to be a devotee. Otherwise, how can you fall into this kind of trap or pit? So Paundraka is given a long leash and he begins to revel in it. He foolishly begins to think that possibly what I'm doing is right and Krishna doesn't have the might to strike me down because so much time has passed and nothing has happened. Often it happens, the Lord's compassion and the Lord's Kshama is taken to be a license for you to think that what you're doing is right and that the Lord is not strong enough possibly. You know, and that is how Paundraka goes on and on, so much so that finally, after imitating everything that Krishna does, as days and weeks and months pass, he begins to imitate more and more and more and more. And you know, finally it leads to one point where he actually thinks of attacking Krishna and defeating him. You know, he goes and tells Krishna that, hey Krishna, what have you done stealing away my discuss, my things? You know, you have stolen all my paraphernalia. He goes and he has the audacity and cheek to tell this. It's like somebody coming and telling, Swami, that robe is actually what I have to wear. I will wear this robe. And this hairstyle is mine. Possibly in some time grow a hair like Swami, wear a robe like Swami. You know, try to imitate things that Swami did in a cheap manner. You know, same way this person is doing that. Paundraka is doing it. And when he goes to that final step of audacity and he tells Krishna that you hand over all the things, it is said that Krishna takes his Sudarshana Chakra and says, this is yours, take it. And he actually grants Paundraka's wish. But the Sudarshana means what? You know, these are all very symbolic, very metaphorical. Darshan means to have the vision of the divine. And Sudarshana, just Su actually means good and purity. that kind of purity, you know, purity exists only with divinity. Nowhere else is that purity there. And therefore, like we said, unless you are of Brahmavid Brahmaiva Bhavati, unless you are the Lord Himself, you have the capacity of the Lord Himself, you can't handle the purity of the Lord. So when Krishna gives his Sudarshana, he actually gives the Sudarshana and Paundraka rushes to catch it. But instead of he being able to catch it, in a trice, Sudarshana just beheads him. And in that single moment, all this false delusion, the empire that Paundraka had built on in imitating Krishna and cheating people by telling that he is Krishna, all comes collapsing down into ruins in a matter of moments. And this Paundraka is another being, another evil being, a foolish evil being who was annihilated and killed by Lord Krishna.
Talking about Paundraka, Swami used to make references to him quite often, because imitators of Swami is not something new, though they've caught our attention now, because we are turning our eyes away from where we have to look for Swami. Swami says, you have to look for me within. When we start looking out, I think we start looking at all of these people. Because even when Swami was there, there were so many of these people all around the place who were claiming to be, you know, some form of Sai Baba or the other, and some claiming to be the consort of Swami, some claiming to be an Amshavatar of Swami or whatever it is. So Swami used to often say that, you know, even in Krishna's time, there was Paundraka and, you know, jokers like this who, I mean, as you beautifully said, what Swami has written, that true devotees will never go there. It is only those who are not able to find that true devotion in their heart, or probably looking for something to hold on to, will falsely go and hold on to something like this. And even in them, if there is any true devotion, I think it's just a matter of time they will turn and come to the right Swami, as we've always seen. Because that is what it is. And as Swami would say in that beautiful Padya, which Swami says, he says, "Ah Maha Vishnuve, ee Mahi Vishnuvai, tana ayudamulu chelchukonnaga vachche," he says. He has come to collect his weapons. So I think the day the wrong weapons are laid claim to will be the end of other Paundrakas too. Just like how Sudarshana was sought after, and then that itself was the nemesis of Paundraka.
And we can see that, you know, as in the case of Paundraka, what leads to such things is unbounded ambition. You know, Swami always says that I am divine and so are you. But the way that thing is channeled, we all are looking for shortcuts. That is where the problem comes. You know, not just the imitators and pranksters, but also as devotees, we are always looking out for a shortcut. You know, rather than sit, it takes time. It takes time for me to connect to my Swami sitting in my altar. In fact, you know, I was just reading the other day one of the earliest discourses of Bhagwan in 1956 or 58. Mm-hmm. I don't remember whether it's Shivratri or Guru Purnima. In that, Swami gives a beautiful analogy. He says, when you start riding a bicycle, you will fall. He says, as you start, you'll run, you'll go to an empty space where there's nobody. You will push the bicycle and leap onto it. But then you'll see that you're tending towards the left side, you lean towards the left and you'll fall. And next time you think that I should keep this in mind and correct myself. So therefore, when you jump up onto your cycle like that, you'll try to correct by going to the right, but now you'll crash to the right side. And he says that this will go on and on and on, and even after a week and many days, you will see that you have not progressed at all. Swami says, but you should not get disheartened, because there will come one point in time where suddenly you will master riding the bicycle. And after that, even for years, if you don't ride the bicycle, and then you are told to ride the bicycle in a crowded market, you will be able to still do it with ease. Swami says, connecting with the Lord, meditating on the Lord is also like that. You will spend lot of time and you will simply not be able to achieve it. But don't give up. Hold on and continue. Because when you continue, there will come that one moment when suddenly you will connect. And once that connection is achieved, after that, irrespective of how much time passes, or irrespective of where you are, you don't need that lamp, you don't need that absolute silence, you don't need agarbattis to build on that atmosphere, nothing. You may be in the middle of a noisy fish market, and yet you will have your connection with the Lord. So Swami says, for that, hold on to the handlebars. What is the handlebar? The name and the form. He says the name and the form are important in meditation. till possibly you become a master, and like a circus person in the circus, you are able to ride the bicycle without holding the handlebars. It is possible to ride a cycle without holding the handlebars, but that's for an expert. And when we start off, we are not experts. Swami says, focus on a single name and a single form. So beautifully Swami has given that, but we are very, very impatient as devotees. I want to achieve it today itself. So therefore, I don't mind changing the form. It is calling itself by the same name. So maybe, so what? So what if the form is different? So what if the form is non-existent? So what if the form is subtle? I can't see it, but the form is there. Everybody says that fellow can see it. You know, this is the kind of impatience that we have, because of which we rush headlong into these kind of things. And it is the same problem even with the imitators. Yes, it's a noble aspiration to want to become Swami, to want to become divine. But that's a path, you know, like it is said that how much ever eager you are, how much ever ambitious and how much ever enthusiastic you are, you can't deliver a baby in less than 9 months. Less than 9 months, in case it happens also, it's called premature and it needs lot of care and attention. They need a lot of intensive care to ensure that such babies survive. That's why they're called premature babies. Same way in this path of spirituality, if we are impatient and I try to, you know, proclaim myself as I am divine before achieving it, I think the same care of intensive care we also need. All of us imitators who try to become like Swami, we need that intensive care, or we need to be supported, ventilator, all that. Otherwise, we are going to die. That's what is going to happen. Because that much time, that patience is necessary before actually reaching that stage. So, in my humble opinion, the root cause for this kind of paundrakas, false imitations arising, is because of impatience on both. Impatience on the part of the imitator and prankster. Impatience on the part of the devotees who are seeking a connect with the Lord. If at all this impatience is replaced with kshama, I think there will be a lot of beauty, tranquility and peace. And most importantly, we won't fall. We will not be choosing Maya over Krishna. We will be choosing Krishna and avoiding Maya.
Even as we were talking about this, I was just reminded of another episode from the life of Kamsa, and which is quite important, because, you know, at that point, when going back to that, you know, he hears the Akashvani, he imprisons his sister and brother-in-law. That is when he imprisons Ugrasena also and takes over the kingdom. And at that time, he realizes that, you know, it's not to be a king, you just don't go and sit on the throne. You have to be a king of the people. The people have to accept you, because otherwise at some point there's going to be a rebellion somewhere, or there's going to be a defection somewhere, and you know your authority is always under threat. So either you cannot be peaceful, you're always worried, or you cannot rule peacefully, and you'll not have that authority and control that you think of. So apparently that's when Kamsa convenes a meeting of all his cruel-minded advisors, and he asks, how do I go about doing this? So then they tell him that, you know, people should not have this hope of a redeemer. They should not feel that a redeemer will come and pull you down. So how do you remove that? And that's when he's talking, I think there's a very beautiful, in fact, this is very significant in that sense. This particular episode is written very beautifully by K.M. Munshi in his book. And the reason why I'm quoting his book is, as I think mentioned this before about his work, he talks of Lord Krishna as a very, very human person. And another observation which I think you had made a couple of weeks back also, that how the nature by which Krishna vanquishes some of the enemies changes after this point, where it becomes far more human and far more indirect than the first few years, when as a child he did it in a very miraculous way and in a very supernatural way. Now it starts becoming very natural. Because, you know, he writes of it as Krishna as somebody who is trying to establish dharma. He says that you need to give people hope that you can stick to dharma and you can still win. So he is always looking at it as going there as a human being and setting people aright, transforming people, transforming rulers, and that's how he goes about his entire mission. The reason where it starts is at this point, where Kamsa says that we need to do something to make people accept me as their king. So at that time, there is this one particular minister who's actually a minister of Jarasandha. And again, we'll come back to Jarasandha, because the reason why Jarasandha comes so many times in this part of Bhagavatam is also very important. So Jarasandha's minister, who is sent to Kamsa's kingdom as one of the people who are there to take care of his daughters. So he gives this advice. He says, see, you cannot do anything about these people who are very righteous, especially the Brahmins and sages. He says they'll always be thinking of the truth, and you know, how much ever you try to dissuade them, they will invariably go in search of the truth. They will not worship you. So then Kamsa says, what do you do? I just want to read out that passage from K. Munshi's book. It's so very beautiful. And even as you read it, you'll see how much it is reflected not only in that scenario which we were talking about of people impersonating Swami, but even in a political firmament, how much this plays out. So, you know, he says, this is Bhavuka's words. He says, mighty prince, if you kill them, the people will turn in against you. If you drive them away from Mathura, they will raise enemies for you wherever they go. Then Kamsa listened to Bhavuka's words in silence, and the old minister continued, mighty prince, there is only one way to destroy the sages and the Brahmins. Open your purse strings to the people. Teach them to eat, drink and enjoy themselves. Break up their families. Teach women that chastity is not worth having at the cost of pleasure. Bring up children to look upon their parents as old and useless. Once the people begin to believe in unrestrained pleasures as the goal of life, they will look upon the ascetics as deranged and the Brahmins as selfish. They will laugh at those who talk of duty, tapas, love and compassion. When wine flows, self-restraint will disappear. Men will be like well-fed cattle at the mercy of their cowherds. Whatever you do, they will bear as patiently as uncomplaining beasts, and obey your lash as if it were a favor from you. These My are the God. Words. I mean, it's so very categorical. It starts with favor. It starts with the king offering you favors to break down your, resistance of
break down your sense of morality. Right?
Morality.
Yes.
So that's how it starts. And I mean, how, as I was saying, in this, the first time I came across this passage was when one of the economists was quoting this particular passage and saying that this is what our politicians are doing to us. You know, when they offer you free sops, when they offer you things that will give you free power, will give you free TV and this, he says they are actually following the Bahuka principle, which is a very established way of breaking down the society so that, you know, leaders who are immoral can rule.
So that unrighteousness right. is tolerated and in fact sometimes celebrated also.
Absolutely.
I mean, when you see people offering a heavy, hefty salary package and pulling away those staff members working at Prashanthi Nilayam to the imitation side.
I mean, that's why this is so directly relevant to that. You know, just going back to how Swami had built this entire ashram. You know, we, many devotees who come now may or may not know of this. I think in the 70s and 80s, I was once speaking to a devotee who came to Swami in the 60s. Even in the 60s, there was a reputation that, you know, people would think that, oh, you come to Swami, you will not get anything. You know, if you're a rich man, you might end up becoming poor. Because Swami had that purity of intention, the purity of, you know, the ability to transform people, that even when he was putting them through that, people had faith in Swami, that, you know, this was good for Swami. I think that for them. You know, that is the power of purity which Swami brought in, and that is how Swami built this whole place. You know, we all know the kind of salaries people got in this place for decades together. You know, still, we have all those people here who served Swami for 30, 40 years. And it shows that, you know, once you're ready to loosen your purse strings, you are actually unleashing unrighteousness, be it in a kingdom or be it in within the devotees. And then it's easier for you to rule.
It's easier for you to, yes. It's like you try to get them into the debt. I mean, all of us are here because we feel indebted to the divine. The attempt made is you become indebted to the wealth, the influence or whatever that is provided. Free foreign travel that is provided. You know, whatever it can be. But once you get them indebted to you, then you feel you can control them. But that is the way of thinking of Paundraka or Kamsa or anybody like that. And though Kamsa and Paundraka are names of the Dwapara Yuga, we have Kamsas, we have Paundrakas, we have in our midst. Only thing, their names are different, but their forms are different, but the attitude is very much the same. So I feel it's for us to choose between Krishna and Maya, and blessed are those who are able to choose Krishna.
And going back to the Bhagavatam, actually, that is one of the reasons why Krishna's nature of dealing with people changes after this point. because he's no more dealing with bad people, but people who have made bad because of some of these things. And that's why Jarasandha is a very important character, because again, going back to K.M. Munshi, the way he portrays Jarasandha, he's supposed to be one of the most powerful kings in Bharatavarsha in that time, in those times. He was supposed to be a very, very powerful king, and because he was cruel, many of these small people did not have the spine to stand up against him. And that is why they ended up becoming friends with him. In the likes of all these Asuras and Paundarakas and all these fellows who were actually spineless, became his confidants and made alliance with him, because it was better to be on his side than to oppose him.
And also it was almost like, by being on his side, I'm getting a spine.
Right.
Because now I can go and tell I'm Jarasandha's, and I seem to get the power, the respect that otherwise I did not have in my life. And therefore, you know, so what if it appears spineless? Once I submit to Jarasandha, I get everything. And the problem that happens is, once all these people join Jarasandha, what happens is that it's like the example of a frog put into water. You know, there is an example, there's an experiment that says that if you put a frog into water and start heating the water, slowly the water temperature will rise, but the frog is getting acclimatized at each rise in temperature.
Right.
Finally, it seems that frog gets cooked. It doesn't jump out of the water even when it's boiling. It gets cooked. On the other hand, you take a frog and put it into boiling water, it immediately hops out, tries to jump out of the water. So that's what happens. Once you come under Jarasandha's, once you come under this reign of this kind of unrighteousness, slowly the unrighteousness quotient is increased day by day. But since you are in the pot of boiling water, you just don't realize until it results in your ultimate demise. So that is the kind of sad end. You know, it's no problem that it is often said one should not be frogs in the well. But I feel it's better to be frogs in a well rather than be a frog in a pot of boiling water that is slowly raising its temperature.
Mm.
On that note, dear listeners, I think we will take a break. On the other side of the break, we will go through the lives of another 2-3 demons, that is Narakasura, Kala, Yavana, Jarasandha, and hopefully we will complete all the annihilations this week. So don't go anywhere. We'll be joining you immediately after the break.
कृष्ण माधव माधव कृष्ण
कृष्ण माधव माधव कृष्ण
कृष्ण माधव माधव कृष्ण
कृष्ण माधव माधव कृष्ण
कृष्ण माधव साई हरे
Kishna Madhava.
ಕೃಷ್ಣ ಮಾಧವ ಸಾಯಿ ಹರಿ.
ವೆಲ್ಕಮ್ ಬ್ಯಾಕ್ ಡಿಯರ್ ಲಿಸ್ನರ್ಸ್. ಬಿಫೋರ್ ವಿ ಟುಕ್ ದಟ್ ಬ್ರೇಕ್ ವಿ ವರ್ ಟಾಕಿಂಗ್ ಅಬೌಟ್ ಜರಾಸಂಧ. ದಟ್ಸ್ ಹೌ ವಿ ಸ್ಟಾರ್ಟೆಡ್ ದ ಟಾಪಿಕ್, ಬಿಕಾಸ್ ದ ನೆಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ ಒನ್ ಆಫ್ ದ ಅದರ್ evil people vanquished through the efforts of Lord Krishna, the other one is Jarasandha. We spoke about how Jarasandha was supposed to be a very, very powerful king and he was very wicked. So many of these people chose to be in his side and embrace that wickedness rather than challenge it. The other thing for which Jarasandha is famous is, I think he proposes to do a yajna where he wants to sacrifice 100 kings or something like that. So I think that must be one of the reasons they'd rather be his ally than to be one of those kings to be sacrificed in that yajna, I guess. Right.
And he has actually, it is said that he has collected 95 already and he's waiting to get 5 more, and sacrificing this will make him the most powerful. It's at this point in time that Krishna comes with the Pandavas to the whatever is the capital of Jarasandha. I think somewhere in modern day Bihar it is. Bihar, okay. Nepal region. I forget the...
Magadha, is it?
Magadha. Yes, Magadha.
Magadha Empire.
Magadha. The Magadhan Empire. So, Krishna comes there with the Pandavas in guise as Brahmins. And when Jarasandha sees, because all said and done, he is a very capable, very skillful, very smart person. So, he sees through the disguise. He doesn't possibly recognize them as the Pandavas, but he definitely knows that these are not Brahmins, because these people are having such well-built bodies and they are so finely sculpted and chiseled. They are definitely Kshatriyas, they are not Brahmins. They are of the warrior class, and they are not people who worship and who are engaged in education. He detects that, but as part of his sacrifice that he is preparing, he has to fulfill the wishes and grant boons to all the Brahmins who visit his kingdom, who come to his kingdom. So in that way, he asks the Brahmins what they want, and his suspicions get clarified by the boon that these Brahmins ask. They say that they would love to have a wrestling match with Jarasandha. No Kshatriya in the kingdom itself would dare to challenge Jarasandha in a wrestling duel, leave alone a Brahmin. And now this Brahmin is asking, so Jarasandha is sure that these are not Brahmins. So therefore he says, I am sure, I will grant, I am ready to fight all of you. And that is when Yudhishthira, you know, I think, who is also in the guise of a Brahmin, he says, no, not all of us, you pick any one of us. That is the point in time where the other Pandavas get nervous, because what if Jarasandha picks Sahadeva? What if Jarasandha picks Nakula? But you know, even in the evil people, generally those days, the kind of righteousness, possibly Jarasandha was evil, but when it comes to following rules, you know, in the rules of warfare, rules of battle, Jarasandha, it is said, you know, in the war, in the Mahabharata war also, these rules were followed till the 10th day, till the great grandsire Bhishma Pitamaha has fallen. Right. Once he falls, all the rules go to dogs and people start violating all the rules of warfare. But till then, it is like a person on horseback fights only a person on horseback. A foot soldier fights a foot soldier. A person on an elephant will fight a person on an elephant. A person in a chariot will fight another person in the chariot. You will not see person in the chariot killing foot soldiers, which happened after the 10th day of the Mahabharata war, but that's a different story. But those were the kind of rules that existed those days, and therefore, though he is such an evil ruler with all sinister designs, Jarasandha, he picks Bhima among all these so-called Brahmins, because he says that among you, only he looks fit enough to fight me, so I will pick Bhima. And Bhima and Jarasandha have to start fighting, and it story goes, I don't know the exact number of days, but the battle between them, the wrestling match, goes on days to the end. It goes on for many days till it comes to a point where Bhima gets up in the morning and tells Krishna that, Krishna, I don't think I can beat him. I don't know, I've tried everything that I can, but Jarasandha simply doesn't seem to be dying. That is when Krishna narrates the story of Jarasandha's birth. He tells him that, see, Jarasandha was actually born to twin mothers. You know, there was a king who had two wives who didn't bear him any children, who he could not get children from, offspring from. Therefore, he and his wife, all three of them do penance. And the sage, I forget his name, the sage gives the king a mango, and he says that this mango will ensure that you have an offspring. The king, being righteous, cuts it into two halves and gives both his wives an half each. And it is said that they deliver half babies. Two half babies are delivered, and the king is scared, and he just gets these half bodies discarded. That is when a cannibal demoness by the name Jara, who smells human meat, comes, and when she sees, she is so enamored by the charming nature of the half body itself. Soon she finds the other half. When she brings those two halves together, the baby lets out a wail. It is said that the baby comes alive. And therefore, the baby is taken care by this ogress, this cannibal called Jara. And it has formed from the sandhi, or the joining of two parts. That's why the child is named Jarasandha. And Krishna reveals this secret to Bhima. And the next day, when Bhima and Jarasandha are engaged in the wrestling match, when it looks like it's a stalemate and nobody is winning, Krishna plucks a leaf, tears it into two halves vertically, throws one half onto the left side, the other half to the right side, and Bhima gets the idea. So he throws Jarasandha to the ground, tears him vertically into two halves, throws them in opposite directions, and that is how Jarasandha is actually killed. And so you see, though it is Bhima who killed Jarasandha, the ultimate credit is to Krishna, because Bhima, after all, was an instrument in the hands of Lord Krishna. And this is the manner in which Lord Krishna ensures that one more scourge on the face of the earth is wiped out. The death of Jarasandha happens this manner.
Right. I think there are a couple of versions of this. One of it is that Bhima keeps tearing apart Jarasandha, but he keeps coming together every time he's torn apart. Mm. Then finally, Krishna gives him that idea of switching the sides. I mean, throw the right side of the body to the left and the left side of the body to the right. And that's how he's killed. But even this, the killing of Jarasandha, as we, I think we might have spoken about this before, it comes as a precursor to the yajna which Yudhishthira is doing, the Rajasuya yajna which he does, when after they move and establish the kingdom in Indraprastha. Krishna tells him that you can't do this. I think Ashwamedha, at that point they do an Ashwamedha. And he says, you cannot do this unless you stamp your supremacy over Jarasandha, who is supposed to be one of those kings who is looked at as unrighteous and very mighty to face. And he says that you have to defeat him, and you have to release all those kings that he has captured,
the 95 kings,
and then all of these people will automatically accept you as an emperor. So that's the precursor to that yajna. But even this, I think there is that other episode of Jarasandha and Lord Krishna and Balarama. I think he comes 18 times, is it? So many times he lays siege over Mathura. And that is when actually Lord Krishna does not face Jarasandha. That's a interesting twist in that story. Even though Krishna defeated all of these asuras whom we talk about, he does not face Jarasandha when he comes to defeat him in Mathura.
The version that I read, it says that Jarasandha's armies were commandeered by a person whose name is Kala Yavana.
Right.
And this Kala Yavana is a very, very powerful general, and it is under his leadership that the armies of Jarasandha attack Mathura. And every time that happens, Krishna leaves Mathura and runs away, you know. And when he leaves and runs away, Kala Yavana is not happy about ransacking or defeating Mathura, because his intent is to finish Krishna. And so with all his armies, he pursues Krishna. And it is said that Krishna wanted to avoid unnecessary bloodshed. You know, he wanted to finish off. It was like a targeted strike, a surgical strike. It was not a mass warfare. He didn't want to do a nuclear strike on these armies of Jarasandha. Because, as we have discussed, there are possibly many good people even in the armies of Jarasandha and Kala Yavana. So, every time Krishna is attacked by the armies of Jarasandha under the leadership of Kala Yavana, Krishna runs further and further away from Mathura. In fact, this act of Krishna has earned him the epithet or name Ranchod Das.
Ranchod, right.
And he is worshipped as Ranchod Das in large parts of North India. Ran means the warfare. Chod is to leave. Ranchod Das, one who leaves the war and runs away. That's how he is.
It's supposed to be derogatory, but in the case of Lord Krishna, it becomes like an endearing name for the Lord.
Just like we call him Chitta Chora.
Chitta Chora, right.
When you call somebody a thief, Swami would often say it is derogatory. But when you call out to the Lord in that manner, it becomes an endearing term. So Ranchod Das is a derogatory term that becomes endearing, and everybody calls Bhagwan Krishna by that manner. So Krishna takes Kala Yavana to a different place, and Kala Yavana is constantly, you know, he's targeting like a heat-seeking missile. He is seeking Krishna with the yellow of his pitambar, with his pitambara. And that is how Kala Yavana is seeking Lord Krishna. And it is said that Lord Krishna, who has the knowledge of the past, present, the future and of everything, he rushes into a cave in which there is this King Muchkunda. Now it's interesting to know King Muchkunda's history also, because it all connects up and you realize how the Lord accomplishes multiple things in one stroke, in one action. In fact, there's Dr. Vijay Kumar. He's an eye surgeon, and he has been responsible for multiple Seva Sadhana camps in Chennai, in the city of Chennai, which was formerly Madras, for the last 4 decades. The setting up of the Sai Krupa Clinic. He's written a book. Is available in our books and publication trust called The Avatar's Prescription.
Okay.
A beautiful inspirational book. So why I went into all this is, in that he says how Bhagwan had told him once that the Lord, the Avatar, is a one, when he does an action, it's like hitting of a billiard ball. Of course, it strikes one ball which goes into the pocket, but it is only the keen eye, it is only the trained eye that will notice that the champion billiard player has hit the ball in such a manner that after striking the ball which goes into the pocket, it comes and strikes the other balls in also such a manner so that there is much more that is accomplished. Because an expert billiard player, once he starts hitting the ball, he never loses a turn and he finishes all the balls on the table. So that is how each strike is made, and we notice that that is how the Lord does even as Krishna. Because Muchkunda, it is said that was a great king who fought tirelessly day and night for the Devas against the Asuras. Because of which he got so fatigued, it is said that when asked for a boon, because of which, you know, because he has been responsible for the victory of the Devas over the Asuras, King Muchkunda asked for a boon of undisturbed long sleep. Something like that. And therefore, he said that if anybody dares to disturb your sleep, it will lead to their own destruction. And it's this King Muchkunda who is sleeping in this cave, and Krishna enters this cave, removes his pitambara dress and puts it on the sleeping Muchkunda and hides in a boulder nearby. Kala Yavana comes in, and finally he thinks he has got Krishna, who has been running away from him for so long. In all his anger, he kicks this sleeping King Muchkunda, who wakes up, and Kala Yavana is destroyed on the spot. Of course, this anger Jarasandha, but we have seen how Krishna later ensures that the death of Jarasandha also happens. So this is how another wicked person, Kala Yavana, is destroyed. King Muchkunda is woken up. And all this is orchestrated in such a beautiful manner by the divine act of Lord Krishna, so that all of these, all of the different boons, all of the different things that have to be accomplished by karma, ensures in Yogakshema for the world, ensures in the maximum benefit for all of the world.
Right. And I think during one of these campaigns by Jarasandha's army and Kale Yavana is when Krishna shifts to Dwaraka from Mathura. I think it's a huge distance. Even now, if you look at the map, I think Mathura is on the almost like on the eastern side of India, and Dwaraka is exactly right opposite, closer to Gujarat in the coast of the western India. And that's the migration which happens. The entire kingdom migrates to Dwaraka, and it is said to avoid battle with Jarasandha's army. And I think it must be interesting to read about Jarasandha too. He also must have some connection with Bhima, that he had to die in the hands of Bhima.
Mm-hmm.
And that's again another thing which you can see, that the preciseness with which this is followed, of whose fate is in whose hand and how each one has to meet their end, is so very clearly followed in all of this. I think even in the Ramayana we've seen that the thing of, you know, who has to kill this, Lakshmana has to kill this person and this person has to die only in the hands of, we even narrated that story of even Lord Yama is not able to kill Ravana because Ravana has to be killed by Rama.
Correct.
So in that sense, the other Asura whom we talk about, of course, there is Shishupala. I think we spoke about Shishupala extensively in the beginning of the Bhagavata Vahini, because the episode of the Rajasuya Yajna starts with the killing of Shishupala. And we spoke about how he has that boon or a leniency of 100 mistakes that he can do, or 100 times he can
insult
Krishna, and after that he will not be forgiven, and that's how he dies. But there is another Asura who is very closely associated with Shishupala, and that is Dantavakra. And whenever we talk about Jaya, Vijaya, we've spoken about that story many times before. They are two guards of heaven who get
Vaikuntha,
who get cursed by the four rishis to be born as enemies of the Lord for three births. And that's how they are first born as Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, then Ravana and Kumbhakarna. And in the third birth, they're born as Shishupala, and the other one being Dantavakra.
It's almost like, you know, their powers kept fading as each
and
birth.
And the importance in the story.
Correct. Because in the beginning, the Lord took birth specifically for them.
Right.
Hiranyaksha also one avatar came. Hiranyakashipu one avatar came. Then for Ravana and Kumbhakarna, one avatar only came.
Right.
Then these are the sidelines. Krishna did not come solely for them. They were just side stories. So that's how Dantavakra was actually one of the vassal kings. When Krishna is on his way to Dwarka after the Rajasuya Yajna, that is when he attacks Krishna, and Krishna has a mace duel with Dantavakra, and he kills him. And I think we had discussed Jaya Vijaya even in our satsang on means versus the ends, because the ends for Jaya and Vijaya was we should return to Lord Vishnu as soon as possible, and therefore when given a choice between choosing 7 births as devotees of the Lord or 3 births as enemies of the Lord, they chose 3 births, not because they wanted to oppose the Lord, but because they wanted to come back to the Lord sooner than 7 births. So that comes in. Apart from that, you know, Swami also mentions Banasura. You know, Banasura was a 1,000 armed king who was a devotee of Lord Shiva. It's again a very interesting long story, but
The story of Narakasura is also another interesting one, where indirectly Krishna kills. And interesting, Narakasura is also one of those confidants of Kamsa who actually advises him. Banasura and Narakasura are the two friends of Kamsa who give him that idea of taking over the kingdom from Ugrasena.
So I'll quickly go through Banasura, and Prem will quickly go through Narakasura. So Banasura is actually a 1,000 armed king, devotee of Lord Shiva. Shiva has promised him protection. And it is said that Banasura had a beautiful daughter by the name of Usha. And Usha used to dream about this handsome young man in her dreams, and she was so enamored by him. It turns out to be Aniruddha, the grandson of Lord Krishna, you know, the son of Pradyumna. And therefore, one of her friends who is a magician, she actually kidnaps Aniruddha in his sleep and gets him here. And when Banasura gets to know that it is Krishna's relative, he is enraged because of his obvious connections with Narakasura and Jarasandha. And therefore, there's a battle that ensues. And in that battle, he realizes that Krishna is going to kill him off. And therefore, he seeks help from Shiva. And it is said that this was a rare occasion when Lord Shiva and Lord Krishna had to take up arms against each other. But there, I forget one astra it is said that Krishna releases that astra which makes Lord Shiva sleepy, and Lord Shiva sleeps, and that is when Krishna chops away all the 1,000 arms of this king, which is symbolic of him chopping away his ego. I don't know whether Banasura is finally slayed or whether he is forgiven and he mends his way, but one thing is sure, that his asura nature, his evil nature, is definitely killed, whether with the killing of his body or whether with the killing of his nature, because I think Lord Shiva comes and says he's under my protection, so just let go. And that way, that is what happens with Banasura.
Actually, I think the grandson of Krishna is married off to the daughter of Banasura. In fact, I think interestingly, they say that the kingdom where Banasura is supposed to have lived and ruled is somewhere around Iraq or Iran of present day.
Oh,
and
my God.
That's how that area is supposed to be ruled by Aniruddha in the future, generations.
Oh, my God. So, that is the distance Aniruddha was carried off.
Right.
Where is India? Where is Iraq?
Huh. Right, right in the center of Europe. And the other one, of course, is Narakasura. We all know him very well because we celebrate Diwali partly to mark the defeat and the death of Narakasura.
He's, I think we went through that story in detail also at that
during time, when we had done the episodes on Deepavali. But nevertheless, the interesting thing about Narakasura is he has a very, very interesting boon, because all of these people end up with asking interesting boons from the lords to, in a way of extending their life. And Narakasura asked this boon of that nobody should be able to kill me other than my mother. And as we have, I think we have spoken about it, Narakasura is actually the mother of, the son of Bhuma Devi. And it's Bhuma Devi who is reborn and reincarnates as Satyabhama, who is another consort of Lord Krishna. And that is how Krishna takes Satyabhama to the battlefield. And he pretends as though he loses, consciousness during the battle. And that's when Satyabhama is enraged by this, and she takes up the bow and she starts fighting, and then she defeats Narakasura.
And we had also discussed how Narakasura is actually the son of Hiranyaksha when he had kidnapped Bhuma Devi. And it is said that, Narakasura, his capital is Prag Jyotishpura. And of course, there are so many levels of inner significance about the annihilation of Narakasura, but that we have discussed during the Deepavali satsang. This Prag Jyotishpura is the modern day Assam. So, that's where it is. And it is here that Lord Krishna frees the 16,000 maidens that have been captured by Narakasura. And this is the origin of the thing that Krishna has 16,000 wives. Because, interestingly, in Sanskrit, the word pati means husband. The word pati also means lord and master. That's why Ganesha is called Ganapati. He's a lord and master of the Ganas. Doesn't mean he's wedded to all the Ganas. In the same way, all these 16,000 maidens, because their entire families have been destroyed and they seek succor from Lord Krishna. They seek his protection, and Krishna becomes their pati, So in that manner, of course, so that is the reason how he takes them under refuge, and that is Narakasura. Dear listeners, there are some more. There is Shambhara, who kidnaps Pradyumna, the son of Krishna and Rukmini, and he gets killed by Pradyumna, interestingly. So, that means Pradyumna is also considered as an avatar. Swami considers Pradyumna also as an avatar of the Lord. So, then there is Kambhoja, there is Kuru, there is Matsya, there is Kaikaya, all these kings. So, we are not going into all those details, but we hope that we have given you a good sample of different kinds of kings and the way, the stratagems that Krishna used. And it is interesting because when they usually have a Bhagavata Parayanam, when they have a Saptaham, when they have a detailed discussion of the Bhagavatam, they go into great details of each of these stories. So people enjoy the story. So there is, apart from the devotional value that comes, there is also a lot of entertainment value. And that is how it is done. So we hope that we have provided that entertainment and devotional value. That has been our prayer, because as we said in the Bhagavata Vahini, Swami simply quickly narrates these names. He doesn't go into details, but we have tried to go into some little detail. But that will be about it. That is where we will be stopping all these annihilations, because I think the next week and possibly a few weeks after that, we will have to go into another list. This is a list of the different kind of avatars, the Amshavatars that Swami mentions in the Bhagavata Vahini.
Right, and I think that list again is very, very interesting, because again it's very insightful when you say that they are avatars, which means the task that they accomplished was divine, was divinely ordained, So that will be very, very interesting. Why they are born, what are the things they have done. And again, it's a list which Swami very, very casually mentions, but I think it would be interesting for us to go into that. As we've always seen, going into these stories, we only get better insights into Swami's message and what Swami wishes us to learn from him. So we'll do that too.
On that note, dear listeners, we would like to bring the satsang to a close. We offer this at the lotus feet of our beloved Swami and pray to him that may we always live in gratitude of the love and grace that he has showered on us. May we always focus on him. May Swami be not just a part of our life, but our life itself. May he be the center of our lives. With that prayer, as always, we offer this at his lotus feet. And dear listeners, your thoughts, your feedback, your feelings, your insights, your experiences, everything is welcome. You can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. Rest assured that we will go through all the feedback, and most of it we try to incorporate into our satsangs. If there is a radically new, different thought, we try to ensure that we do a complete satsang on it itself and a separate date. So do write to us at listener@radiosai.org. We shall sit for the satsang again next week, same time, at 12:30. So till then, it's Sai Ram from both of us, Prem and Arvind. We leave you with the song, Bhajan. On the other side of this Bhajan, you will have Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.